welcome to the Turkish History Podcast, Episode 5, The Ten Arrows. Last time, we left off with the death of Tardu, the last Khan to ever so briefly rule the whole Turkish Khanate. His death marked the end of the united Göktürk state and the beginning of two separate states. Now, as we'll cover next time, the Eastern Khanate would fall under Chinese influence. But for now, we're going to stay in the West, where Tardu's successors would have to grapple with his fall. In general, from here on, the trend for the Western Turkish Khanate is going to be to lose influence, lose power, lose authority. But this is not a straight line. As we will see, the Western Khanate will undergo a renaissance and a revival. And it was not a foregone conclusion. There's no reason the revival necessarily had to end. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. So let's back up to where the story stands now. Tardu died in 603, and he had died fighting to put down a widespread revolt to overthrow him. A revolt led in part by his own Ashina family members. Tardu, having shown himself to be willing to shed Ashina blood, was just too dangerous to be left on the throne. But it wasn't just an Ashina revolt. Remember that the Göktürk state, though more centralized than prior steppe empires, was still a confederation. The sub-tribes remained in existence and still had power below the upper level of the Khanate's administration. For example, the Byzantine sources always mention these component tribes as having a certain degree of authority and power over their territories on the steppe. And the further away from the Göktürk heartlands in today's Kazakhstan that you got, the more power these component tribes would have had. So in the far west, the lands around the Volga and the Sea of Azov, the control of the Khan was probably the weakest. Now, these uprisings to overthrow Tardu had included these western tribes, and it appears that it was around this time that the Khazars, the Onugars, and the Bulgars first slipped free of effective control by the central Turkish state. Indeed, it is very likely that these tribal confederations first formed as political units during this time. It's also very likely that these revolts of the steppe peoples coincided and overlapped with the revolts of the Ashina leaders. That is, that the Ashina Shahs either led the revolts or were picked up by the rebels and propped up as sort of puppet leader of the revolts. We know, for example, that Ashina descendants headed the Khazar Confederation for over a century. There is also some evidence that the Turks also faced uprisings among the settled Sogdian city-states, though again we don't know the particulars. I think we should imagine these city-states seeing what they could get away with in the chaos, withholding tribute, potentially reaching out to China and to Iran to see what the emperor and the Shah could do for them. At this point, the ties between the Sogdians and the Turks began to shift. More independence for the Sogdian city-states, but still acknowledging some form of Turkish overlordship over them, but with far less direct control. Most important was the ongoing Tele revolt. This revolt would continue in some form from 600 to about 620, but we shouldn't think of this as 20 years of total chaos and war. Instead, the Tele resistance and power would ebb and flow, at times at war with the Khan, at times at peace, at times in submission, at times in revolt, but always maintaining a political center and at least a degree of autonomy. All of this unrest adds up to a sort of centrifugal force, weakening the authority of the Khan over the tribes and the subject peoples, even pulling the more far-flung component parts of the Khanate out of the gravitational orbit of the state entirely. So it was amidst this chaos that the succession to Tardu in the West began in 603. But this raises a question. Why would there necessarily be two successors to Tardu at all? Why would the empire be divided between East and West? Now, some of this goes all the way back to what we discussed in Episode 2. Ishtami's court in the West had developed an independent state of a sort within the Khanate. And even when Tardu had ever so briefly conquered the East, he hadn't actually knitted together a single administration. Tardu's reign as the sole Khan had been incredibly brief. He hadn't built a unified state. The institutions of East and West had diverged over time, and the sort of exceptional leader who could have kept the state united just never emerged. Another key reason was that the clear successor to Tardu in the east was Yami Khan, that puppet Khan who the Sui dynasty had set up to oppose Tardu and who we introduced last time. Well, after Tardu's death, Yami Khan was able to use Sui's support to become the Khan in the east. Therefore, the east was headed by a Sui vassal, a Sui puppet. And I think the Western nobility just could not accept a Chinese vassal as their Khan, so that was a non-starter. So it was in the context of these revolts, the weakening of central authority and the aftermath of Tardu's death, that the Western Khanate acquired the name that it was known by among the Turks of the time, Onok, or the Ten Arrows. This name comes from a group of 10 Turkish tribes that had come to form the core of the Western Khanate, each represented by one arrow. The tribes were divided into two factions, the Dolu and the Nushibi. As the state faced widespread revolt, it needed to rely on these factions, these core tribes of the state, these 10 arrows, to put down the revolts. This made the 10 arrows extremely powerful within the state. As the only force totally loyal to the Khanate, they were now absolutely critical to its survival. This elevated their importance, and they shifted from being the foremost of the Western Khan's nobles, the core of his military, into being kingmakers, or Khan-makers as the case may be. These 10 tribes became the anchor of the state. And without a powerful, sort of exceptional Khan on the top, the divisions between the two factions, between the Dolu and the Nushibi, became deeper and more serious. If a Khan was beholden to one faction, then it could turn out very, very badly for the other faction. So while the Ten Arrows would fight to restore the Khanate's power, at the same time, each faction would now come to struggle for control and influence within the Khanate itself. That is, power over the other faction. Now, as we briefly discussed back in Episode 3, this organization of the Ten Arrows goes all the way back to Ishtami's time. Menander, for example, reports that the Western Khanate was divided into 8 tribes at the time of Ishtami's rule, 5 Dolu and 3 Nushibi. Now, the origins of this system are shrouded in mystery, but the story that I find most persuasive is that these two factions emerged from the military organization of the Western Khanate established by Ishtami. These tribes began as a military organization that then evolved beyond mere military units and into full-on tribes. Under Ishtami, the military corps of the western half of the Khanate was organized into army units of 10,000 men each, called tumen. Now, this system of military organization on the basis of 10,000 men continued on the steppe even after the end of the Turkish Khanate, and it would be used by the Mongols and by others. As a side note, the word tumen itself has actually lived on into the modern day, but in Farsi, not Turkish. It is the origin of the Farsi word tolman, which means 10,000, and is typically used only for currency units in Iran today, having come to mean 10 rials. Though Turkish is full of Farsi words, this is one of the very, very few Turkish words that have been borrowed by the Persians. And it's interesting to note that, like most of the Turkish loanwords in Farsi, this was originally a military word. But I'm getting off track with this etymology detour, so let's go back to the story of the Ten Arrows. So these Tumen military units were then organized into the steppe east, west, and left, right wings. These military units were the most loyal and highly ranked troops under the Khan's control, outside of the Khan's personal household troops and his bodyguard. These were not subject tribes, they were inner core elites. In time, over the reigns of Ishtami and Tardu, these military units became more than just military units. They became tribes. Their powerful esprit de corps, their constant travel and life together along with their families, over a period of 2 generations of nearly constant campaigning, erased the prior loyalties to the tribes that their fathers had been members of. These military units then became tribes in and of themselves. The left/eastern wing Dolu were the senior branch, and the western right wing Nushibi were the junior branch. This follows the traditional left-right dichotomy in Turkish steppe military formations. Now initially, the Nushibi were only composed of 3 tribes, as opposed to the 5 Dolu tribes. This system then further evolved, and an extra 2 Nushibi tribes came into existence during Tardu's reign, maybe as he expanded the military in pursuit of his wars with Iran and China. A later Chinese source says, "The Khan of the Western Gok Turks divides his state into 10 parts, and each was headed by one man. Together they made up the 10 shads. Every shad is given an arrow by him. Thus they were known as the 10 arrows. He also divided the 10 arrows into two factions. Each consisted of 5 arrows." Now this was probably a bit of retconning by the Chinese. It seems from the Roman sources that this 10-arrow system actually began earlier than the Chinese said it did, but the basics seem right. Most likely, this arrow-giving ceremony was repeated by new khans of the Western Khanate, and the Chinese saw a later iteration of the ceremony and sort of assumed it was a novel thing. Now, as I said, these factions were based on the traditional left-wing, right-wing, east-west dichotomy of Turkic rule. The Dolu in the east, the Nushibi in the west. But this was within the Western Khanate, so the Dolu were in the east of the Western Khanate, and the Nushibi in the west of the Western Khanate. The Ili River in modern-day Kazakhstan formed the rough boundary between their spheres of influence, but this was not a hard boundary. Importantly, the east-west division within the Western Khanate meant that each faction was primarily oriented toward a different set of settled peoples. Remember, as we've said over and over again, steppe societies always develop in concert with their settled neighbors. The Nushibi were therefore deeply connected to the Sogdian city-states of the Silk Road in Central Asia, whereas the Dolu had closer relations to the Eastern Khanate and to the Chinese. So after Tardu died, these two factions each backed a separate candidate from the Ashna family to succeed him, but from two different lines. The Dolu faction backed Taman, who was a grandson of Mukan Khan. Thus, Taman was of the line of Bumin, a member of the court of the Eastern Khanate, not the line of Ishtami. Perhaps the Dolu, being more focused towards the east, were eager to bring in a prince of the Eastern court, maybe in an attempt to keep the whole Göktürk Khanate united. The other candidate was Şegüy, a grandson of Tardu who was backed by the more western Nushibi faction. Now, we don't know the details of the Kurultai or the succession, but it's clear that the Dolu faction got their way and Taman was able to succeed Tardu. We know very little about Taman's reign directly, but its start was almost certainly consumed by putting down revolts. He inherited the throne as the Khanate was engulfed by the revolts that overthrew Tardu. Yet he appears to have consolidated and stabilized the situation somewhat after coming to power, putting down revolts of the Ashna princes, and having some success in enforcing authority over the rebel tribes. But he was not universally successful, and he was constantly working to restore order. And some peoples had just slipped the yoke entirely, never to return. For example, the Greek kingdom of Bosporus in the Crimea, subjugated by Tardu's brother Tamgan, ceased to be a Turkish vassal at this time. It would never again fall under Göktürk rule. In the west, it was under Taman's reign that the Khazars, the Bulgars, and the other western Onuwar confederations were initially brought to heel. But they were not destroyed. Instead, these tribal unions, likely very recently formed confederations, were reincorporated into the Khanate. And even though they were reincorporated, they likely retained far broader and expansive powers for themselves than the westernmost tribes had had during the reigns of Ishtami and Tardu, especially in the beginning. We don't know the specifics of the relationship with the Khanate, but at least under Taman's reign, I think we should imagine this starting as likely more of a recognition that this new Khan was higher ranked, and it was only with time and effort that the Khanate was truly able to consolidate its control over them. And indeed, the Turkish Khanate likely never regained the sort of complete control over these new larger confederations that it had had over the smaller tribes and confederations that had preceded them on the western steppes. Remember that when the Turkish Khanate first swept west, it was a state of unseen sophistication on the western steppe. The Turks took the relatively sophisticated models of state structure born on the Chinese borderlands and carried them west, to peoples who had never seen a steppe state organized in such a way. Well, now they had seen it. And in the chaos that follows Tardu's death, they formed their own larger and more sophisticated confederations. So when they were eventually reincorporated, it was not as the smaller tribes that had preceded the Göktürk and who could be easily dominated, but it was as larger confederations, who were harder to tame and harder to keep in line. For example, this is the time that we first begin to see references to the Khazars, an Oğuz Turkic confederation in the far west of the Khanate. After the fall of the Western Khanate, the Khazars will eventually go on to found their own powerful steppe confederation, though it would never be as large or as powerful as the Turkish Khanate that it had emerged from. At this time, though, the Khazars were clearly a component tribal confederation underneath the Turkish Khanate. Later Western sources eventually would refer to the Turkish Khanate as the Khazars, but this is basically a retroactive misnaming. At the time that these later sources were written, it was the Khazars who were the power in the north, the Turkish Khanate being long gone. The Khazars at this time were instead a powerful tribal coalition underneath the Khan, greatly powerful within the Western Khanate and led by an Ashina leader, but not a part of the truly inner core made up by the Ten Arrows. In the eastern part of this Western Khanate, relations with the Tiele remain tense. The Chinese sources say that Taman collected taxes from them, but that the relationship later soured, ultimately leading to his fall. It's possible that Taman came to power with the support of the Tiele after Tardu's death, and the relationship then began to worsen after he tried to assert his authority over them. The Tiele, being geographically located in the east of the Western Khanate, in the lands of the Dolu, may have had relatively good relations with the Dolu faction backing Taman, but we just can't be too sure about any of this. We also know that Taman appointed sub-khans, including his rival and ultimate successor Shegui, and the man who would ultimately lead the renaissance of the Western Khanate, Shegui's brother, the famous Tong Yabgu Khan. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. The Chinese sources don't tell us a lot about Taman. There is one reference to Taman submitting to the Sui as a vassal in 608 and accepting a title from the Sui court. Now, if Taman had indeed accepted vassal status to the Sui, it was almost certainly nominal. A way to get money and a way to shore up his legitimacy. Recognition from a Chinese emperor is a potent symbol, a stamp of approval. There is also a reference to Taman commissioning the building of semi-permanent summer and winter capitals north of modern-day Tashkent, which would certainly imply that he had stabilized the situation in the Western Khanate somewhat. But we do have a bit more information about Taman's reign from the Western sources, because Taman was the Khan who led the Turks into the second Göktürk-Persian War. Now, we discussed the first Göktürk-Persian War last time, how Tardu had overextended himself and the Turks had lost horribly. And just like last time, the origin of this second war began with an utterly suicidal and mutually destructive great war between Iran and Byzantium. So what caused this latest, and ultimately the last, round of Persian-Roman bloodshedding? The previous war had come to an end in 591, when Emperor Maurice helped Khosrau II, also called the Great, regain the throne of Iran. This led to a period of peace for about 10 years. But then, in 602, Maurice was murdered and succeeded by his rival, Phocas. These events led to a political crisis in Byzantium, and the dead emperor's faction reached out to Khosrau for aid, and Khosrau was of course more than happy to oblige. Likely both because of his personal friendship with Emperor Maurice and because he saw an opportunity. He invaded Byzantine territory in 602, beginning a war that would last for over 20 years, and would ultimately leave the Persians and the Byzantines so weakened and exhausted that they would prove to be no match for the conquering armies of Islam. The only contemporaneous source we have for the Second Göktürk-Persian War is the History of Sebaeus, written by an Armenian monk and chronicler. Now, there is an interesting line in Sebaeus' history where he claims that an Armenian petty king had subjected himself to two kings of the Kushans, Shog and Parlovk. But these two kings were leaders of a tribal confederation affiliated with the Turks, potentially even sub-khans or shads of the Khan himself. The fact that these sub-tribes were able to be in such a direct relationship with an Armenian petty king, basically a local warlord, may show the extent of the troubles the Western Khanate was facing after Tardu's death. Remember, the Khan's main feature, his main purpose, was to manage the relationship with settled peoples. The Khan, theoretically, was supposed to have a monopoly over foreign relations. If subject tribes were actually engaging in outside diplomacy directly themselves, it would imply a real breakdown of the Khan's authority. So this second Göktürk-Persian War began with these Kushans invading and raiding the area around Tus, a city in Khorasan. Now, Khorasan is the area that today forms northeastern Iran, Turkmenistan, and parts of Afghanistan. But these Kushans were then routed by the Iranians and fled back north. From there, the great Khan of the West, Taman, assembled his army and began marching south into Iran. The army raided deep into Iran. Sabaos says, they struck at the Iranian troops, putting Datoya into flight, and then spread out, raiding as far as the borders of Rey and the district of Aspahan. After devastating the entire country, they turned back to their army, and a command came from the Great Khan to recross the river and return home. Now, it is possible that the Romans sent an embassy to the Turks to persuade them to go to war, but we don't have a source saying this. Unfortunately, Menander's history ends kind of just before this breaks out. That doesn't mean it didn't happen definitively, but the lack of an embassy also sort of agrees with what Sabaos implies, that this war was caused not by a Roman-Turkish alliance, but by raiders from the periphery of the Western Khanate getting into trouble and then dragging their overlord into the fight. Potentially, Tahman saw this as a way to enhance his own authority, to send his army south to raid Iran to get booty, and as a way to solidify his power and enforce his monopoly over foreign relations. Nevertheless, the start of this second war was certainly in part caused by the war between Iran and Rome. Seeing that the Persians were distracted fighting the Romans in Anatolia, the Turks saw an opportunity to strike. Sabaos relates that, as before, the Turks were eventually defeated by the Persians and that the leader of the Turkish army was killed in hand-to-hand combat with an Armenian commander. But this is almost certainly an invention. Basically, every single source that says that two leaders fought hand-to-hand should be seen with a heaping spoonful of salt. It just doesn't happen. Nonetheless, it is clear that the invasion was not a success. Or was it? Perhaps the purpose of this war was a raid, to take advantage of Persian distraction and their focus on the war with the Byzantines in the west, to let the Shah know that there was still a power to the north, to provide the tribes of the Confederation with booty, to demonstrate to the tribes that the Khan alone has the power to deal with the outside world. And having raided, having gathered booty, having cemented his authority over the tribes of the steppes, having given the Shah something to think about, Tahman Khan simply returned home. To me, this makes much more sense given what we know about how steppe confederations work and what we know about Tahman's reign. Ultimately, though, Tahman was not able to hold on to power. Emperor Yang of the Sui, the successor to the recently deceased founder, Emperor Wen, had been cultivating Shigui and had finally agreed to send him a Sui princess to marry. Likely the fact that Tahman was a descendant of Bumin, not Ishtami, played a role in Tahman being unable to hold on to power in the West. The descendants of Ishtami would have been grumbling and plotting behind his back the whole time. Maybe his relations with China were especially provocative. Would this Easterner force them to bend the knee to China? By 612, Tahman had been outmaneuvered by those sub-khans of the line of Ishtami that he himself had appointed, the brothers Shigui and Tong Yabgu Khan. According to Chinese sources, Shigui and the Chinese emissaries basically persuaded Tahman that it would be better for his health and the health of his family if he retired to the east, where his family, the line of Bumin, belonged. So Tahman packed up shop and left, leaving the west to the descendants of Ishtami. He was succeeded by Shigui Khan. Now, Shigui Khan is basically remembered as merely a precursor to his famous brother, Tong Yabgu Khan, under whom the Western Khanate will experience its renaissance and revival. And in truth, we have very little information about his rule. His rule marked the beginning of the ascendancy of the Nushibi faction over the Dolu. They were the people who put him in power. Now remember, the Nushibi were the western wing, closer to the western regions of the Western Khanate. The return to power of the line of Ishtami in the west, backed by the Nushibi, likely meant a further westward drift in the orientation of the Western Khanate. We know that Shigui provided security for the Silk Road, and according to the Book of Tang, he extended the rule of the Western Khanate from the Altai Mountains in the east to the sea in the west. But it's unclear if the Book of Tang meant the Caspian or the Black Sea. For Chinese sources, both of these distant seas were basically semi-mythical. He primarily camped in the foothills around the mountains of modern-day Kyrgyzstan, campaigning against the Tele and consolidating the Western Khanate's power. That's it. That's all we know about him. Though I think it's fair to assume that he probably strengthened the authority of the state over the tribes and laid the groundwork for the coming reign of his brother. Shigui Khan ultimately died in 618, following which his brother, Tong Yabgu Khan, succeeded him. Now, as Shigui's brother, Tong Yabgu Khan was a grandson of Ishinami. And just like his brother, he was backed by the Nushibi faction, the Western Five Arrows of the Ten Arrows. Tong Yabgu Khan would go on to rule for a decade, and he would lead the Western Gyokuturk Khanate to a revival of its power and oversee a cultural renaissance before its final fall. It seems that the first thing Tong Yabgu Khan did was crush the Taelae Rebellion, which had been going on in some form since Tardu's final years about 20 years earlier, with varying degrees of intensity. We don't have details of the battles, but the Chinese sources confirm that he defeated the Taelae and became master of the Ili Valley Basin. He generally kept his court in the area around Lake Issyk-Kul in Kyrgyzstan, and the steppes on the border of modern-day Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan along the river Talas, where, in a century, the armies of Islam would square off against the Tang Dynasty. With the Taelae finally brought to heel, Tong Yabgu Khan then embarked on a program to strengthen the central administration of the Khanate. He sent tax collectors, that is the Tuduns, to the subject peoples of the Khanate. This would not just have improved revenue, it would have cemented the Khan's control over the tribal confederations and subject peoples. The Chinese sources say that he made all the tribes subject to him. As part of this project to entrench the authority of the central administration, Tong Yabgu Khan also appointed and dispatched members of the Ashina clan to serve as shahs over the subject peoples and tribes. One of these, his nephew Buri Shad, was dispatched to the far west, to the lands north of the Caucasus between the Caspian and the Black Sea, to consolidate the Khanate's control over those new, larger tribal confederations recently brought back into the fold, the Khazars, the Bulgars, and the Onors. This revival of central power was of course predicated on military strength, and it was his victory over the Taelae and his campaigns to finally put to rest the remainders of the rebellions across the Khanate that gave Tong Yabgu Khan the legitimacy and the ability to finally complete the re-establishment of the Khanate's authority. We don't know the exact details, but within 5 years of his accession to the throne, it appears that he had effectively re-knit the frayed Khanate, completing the work of Taman and Shigui to reassert the state's power. We do have one remarkable source, however, a travelogue, written by a man named Xuan Zhang, a Chinese Buddhist monk who traveled through the Khanate on a pilgrimage to India. Now, according to Zhang, the realms of the Western Khanate were by this point divided into 27 states, each with separate chiefs, but all subject to the Khan. But we don't know how Zhang was counting the states. Were these 27 tribes? Does the number include the sedentary city-states subject to the Khan? Does it include the elites like the Ashina clans or the Ten Arrows? Or is it just the subject tribes? We have no way of knowing. Zhang also gives us insights into the religious practices of the Khanate. He mentions various Buddhist monasteries and says that they were supported by the Khan. This is also borne out by writings by contemporary Indian missionaries and merchants coming into the Turkish lands. Zhang says that the Buddhist practices in Central Asia used the original Indian language, as opposed to studying the scripts in translation. In 626, we also have references in Indian sources to a Hindu priest being accepted into Tong Yabgu Khan's court. So it appears that Tong Yabgu Khan was a patron of both Buddhist practices, which would have marked a continuation of the religious policy of Tospar and Mukan Khan, and perhaps of more traditional Hindu practices from India. But this doesn't mean that he would have turned his back on the traditional Tengriist practices of the Turks. As we've discussed before, the Turks were not monogamous when it came to religious practices. They took from everybody. Zhang also mentions various Turkish bandits and robbers extorting pilgrims in monasteries, which seems pretty likely, and would imply limits on the Khan's control over the tribes and his ability to keep the peace. Even though Tong Yabgu Khan had strengthened the state, the various tribes of the Khanate would still do what the tribes always did, raid and pillage. There were certainly limits on the Khan's power over the component tribes, and it seems likely that Tong Yabgu Khan never enjoyed quite the same level of control over the tribes that Ishtami and Tardu had. Zhang was even brought before the Khan in a formal royal audience, and provides us with a remarkable portrait of Tong Yabgu Khan near the height of his power. He said, "The Khan wore a green satin robe. His hair, which was 10 feet long, was free. A band of white silk was wound around his forehead and hung down behind. He was surrounded by 200 Tarkhans, all clothed in brocade, with their hair braided. On the right and the left, he was attended by troops, clad in furs and fine-spun hair garments, carrying lances, bows, and standards, and mounted on camels and horses. They sat in a pavilion adorned with golden flower ornaments, which blinded the eye with their glitter. Now these troops on the left and the right were the representatives of the two wings of the Ten Arrows, the left Dolu and the right Nushibi. And this is a visual representation of the key strength of Tong Yabgu Khan and the root of all of his successes. Critically, though he had been put on the throne by the Nushibi and was probably not the most popular guy in the world with the Dolu clan still recognized his legitimacy. Tong Yabgu Khan did not needlessly provoke them. He did not overly favor the Nushibi. He recognized that he needed both wings of the Ten Arrows, and treated even those Dolu opposed to him as something like a loyal opposition, not like inveterate enemies. This, more than anything, is what allowed him to stabilize the Western Khanate. So internally, Tong Yabgu Khan cemented the power and legitimacy of the Khanate. He oversaw a shaky peace between the two great factions, he stopped the centrifugal forces unleashed on Tardu's death, and rebuilt the state's authority, at least in part, if not completely. So what about in foreign relations? Well, remember that both Shegui and Tong Yabgu Khan were candidates supported by the more Western Nushibi faction. They were therefore more oriented towards the West, and events in the West had taken a turn for the worse. By the time that Tong Yabgu Khan had come to power, the war between the Byzantines and the Persians had become a brutal and bloody slugfest. Emperor Heraclius came to power in 610, overthrowing the usurper Phocas. Heraclius was a competent and energetic emperor. But Shah Khosrau the Great and his generals, including the famous Shahin and Shahrbaraz, were also incredibly competent and energetic. Beginning in 613, the Iranians were on a tear. They invaded and conquered the Levant and Egypt, tearing them away from Roman rule for the first time ever. Not since the Achaemenid Persian Empire, thousands of years earlier, prior to Alexander the Great, had Persian rule extended to the shores of the Mediterranean. Khosrau famously sent the following letter to Heraclius. "Khosrau, greatest of the gods and master of the earth, to Heraclius, his vile and insensate slave. Why do you still refuse to submit to our rule and call yourself a king? Have I not destroyed the Greeks? You say that you trust in your God. Why has he not delivered out of my hands Caesarea, Jerusalem, and Alexandria? And shall I not also destroy Constantinople? But I will pardon your faults if you submit to me, and come hither with your wife and children. And I will give you lands, vineyards, and olive groves, and look upon you with a kindly aspect. Do not deceive yourself with vain hope in that Christ, who was not able to save himself from the Jews, who killed him by nailing him to a cross. Even if you take refuge in the depths of the sea, I will stretch out my hand and take you, whether you will it or not." Meanwhile, the Persian general Shahin led a devastating invasion of Anatolia in 615. But Heraclius and the Romans didn't take this sitting down. Heraclius organized massive counterattacks, invading east through Armenia and striking into the Iranian heartland beginning in the early 620s, just as Tong Yabgu Khan was consolidating his rule in Central Asia. Both the Romans and the Persians employed Arab tribal confederations, arming these Arabs to attack their rivals' desert underbelly. The success and brutality of these Byzantine counterattacks convinced the Persians to reach out to the Romans and say, "Hey, this is all getting out of hand, and really we need to come to some sort of understanding. Let's recognize reality here. These wars are breaking both of us. I mean, one more victory like this, and we're in serious trouble. And really, we would both be better off not calling in these Arabs and Avars and Turks that we've been getting to fight for us. I mean, who knows? They might turn out to be a big problem for both of us if things keep going on like this." I'm just kidding, of course. The Persians instead reached out to the Avars and said, "You need to attack Byzantium. Name your price, whatever it is, we will pay it." So in 626, the Persians, aided by their Avar allies, launched a massive siege of Constantinople that would last for a year. This great siege, conducted by the Avars on the European walls and the Persians on the Anatolian shore opposite the Eternal City, convinced the Romans that they had to go get their own nomad allies. And so, in 626, While Constantinople itself was under siege, Heraclius sent ambassadors by boat past the Persian encampments on the Bosphorus, through the Black Sea, over the steppes, and to the court of Tong Yabgu Khan. According to the Armenian historian Movses Kagakhanvatsi, Heraclius said, "If the Turks help me in this undertaking, I will satisfy the thirst of these bestial, gold-loving tribes of long-haired men." One source says that the embassy was led by a man named Andrei, but we can't be sure about the names here. We do know that the Byzantine embassy first stopped off at the court of Buri Shad, who, remember, had been appointed as Shad over a part of the Western Khanate, before going on to Tong Yabgu Khan, where the Byzantines begged the Turks to intervene. An Armenian source has Tong Yabgu Khan giving a flowery acceptance, saying, "I shall avenge Heraclius on his enemies, and shall arise and go to his aid in person with my brave army. I shall satisfy him by warring with sword and bow as he wishes." But of course, we don't actually know what the negotiations were about. From the Turks' perspective, defeating the Iranians had its own benefits, of course. Crushing the Iranian influence over the Silk Road cities would cement the Khanate's rule in Sogdiana. Furthermore, Tong Yabgu Khan had a duty to provide the fruits of booty and raiding to his followers. Having restored the prestige of the Khanate following the chaos in the civil war and the disorder following the death of Tardu, he was now in a position to do this. And perhaps most importantly, if things went really well, perhaps the Turks could expand past the Amudarya and conquer parts of Iran. The Iranian state was overextended and was already showing its exhaustion with decades of constant war. Tong Yabgu Khan was clearly interested in extending his rule even further south, into Khorasan and Balkh, which are the lands of modern-day Turkmenistan, northeastern Iran, and Afghanistan. Who knows? Maybe the Turks could even become overlords of the whole Iranian state. And so, in 627, after the Persians and the Avars were forced to call off their siege of Constantinople, the Romans and the Turks launched another joint invasion of Iran. The Romans would march east across Armenia, while the Turks would fall down upon the Iranian plateau from the north. The Turkish forces were almost certainly led by Buri Shad and not Tong Yabgu Khan himself, though some scholars do think that the Khan may have led his troops during the invasion. The Byzantine sources mention a leader they call Zabel, who was said to be the second most powerful person in the state. For example, Theophanes the Confessor says the Turks invaded Iran under their general Zabel, who was second in rank to their Khan. This makes it extremely likely that it was in fact Buri Shad and not the Khan himself who led the Turks in person. And this kind of makes sense. Though Tong Yabgu Khan had reasserted the authority of the Khanate, leaving the heartlands of the Khanate in today's Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan was likely far too risky at the time, especially given the shaky peace between the two factions of the Ten Arrows. Who knew who could rise up to try to replace him in his absence? Regardless of who was in charge, the Turks invaded Iran through the Caspian Gates, also called the Gates of Alexander. The Turks marched south along the west coast of the Caspian Sea with a massive horde and laid siege to the Iranian city of Derbent. Derbent today lies in the very south of modern Russia on the Caspian Sea, about 250 kilometers north of Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. This northern pass, these gates, were the best way from the steppe to the central plateau of Iran. Derbent guarded these northern passes into Iran, and it was the key to keeping back the steppe forces, and as such, it was heavily fortified. Now, the Turks at this time were not renowned for siege warfare. In time, of course, the Turks will become famous for their ability to knock down city walls with their cannons, but that's not going to be for many centuries. For now, their strength lay on the steppe and in steppe warfare. In cavalry, in horse riders who could strike their enemies with speed and then melt back into the steppe, who could ride just as well as they could walk. It was not in laying siege to cities protected by towering walls. But remember that the Sassanids were fighting on two fronts. In order to counter the Byzantine attack coming from the west through Armenia, they had denuded Derbent of troops, and it was held only by light militia forces. And so the Turks were able to sack Derbent. According to Kagakhanvatsi, at the arrival of the all-powerful scourge, the universal wrath confronting us, the Turks, like billowing waves of the sea, crashed against the walls and demolished them to their foundations. In Partal, seeing the terrible danger from this multitude of hideously ugly, vile, broad-faced men without eyelashes, and with long, flowing hair like women which descended upon them, a great terror seized the inhabitants. After taking Derbent, the Turkish armies plundered their way south to link up with the Romans in front of Tbilisi, the capital city of Georgia, which the Byzantines called Lazica at that time. Theophanes says, "In the places they traversed, they took Persian prisoners and burned their cities and villages. The emperor left Lazica to meet them. When Zabel saw him, he ran toward him, bowed his neck, and prostrated himself before him. The Persians saw this from the walls of Tiflis." The Roman sources then mention that the Borishad and the Turks acclaimed Heraclius and abased themselves in front of the Romans, even giving their children to the Romans to be raised. They're just absolutely awestruck at how awesome and cool the Romans are. Obviously, none of that's made up by Roman sources, of course. Obviously. Now, both the Turks and the Romans had reasons for attacking Tbilisi. Tbilisi, today the capital of Georgia, was also the capital of the Georgian kingdom of the time. And this Georgian kingdom was a critical vassal of the Sassanids, who had placed the current ruling family on the throne. Its position on the Black Sea made it a potentially dangerous enemy of Byzantium, and its position just north of the Armenian highlands and the mountains of eastern Anatolia made it a key to the borderlands between Byzantium and Iran. So from the Roman perspective, crushing this kingdom gave them an open road into Iran. For the Turks, this was the kingdom guarding the rich lands of the south from the steppes. It was on the far side of the walls of the Caucasus Mountains. Now, the ancients had called the Caucasus the walls against Gog and Magog, separating civilization from the monstrous peoples of the steppes. So for the steppe peoples to finally control the passes, to finally be able to unleash Gog and Magog into the rich settled world, this would be a huge advantage. And it would give them access to raid, plunder, and perhaps even conquer the settled civilizations in Iran, Anatolia, and the Middle East. But this first siege of Tbilisi was not successful. Having encircled and invested the city, the siege bogged down. There were frequent sorties and attacks, but after a couple of months, the Turks and the Byzantines were forced to lift the siege in order to continue the campaign before winter set in. While the siege wasn't a success for the Byzantines and the Turks in the sense that Tbilisi did not fall, they had done enough in Georgia that they could leave and continue marching forward, leaving Tbilisi and the Georgians to their rear. From here, the two armies diverged. The Turks invaded northern Iran and modern-day Azerbaijan, and then ultimately returned to Tbilisi, finally succeeding in sacking it. Heraclius and the Romans headed south, into Mesopotamia, where they defeated the Sassanids in front of the ancient city of Nineveh, dealing the Persian Empire a blow that it would ultimately never recover from. While Heraclius could not destroy the Persian capital of Ctesiphon near modern-day Baghdad, the writing was on the wall. Facing certain defeat, the Persian army mutinied, overthrew Khosrau, and raised his son up as Shah. The Shahnameh says that when Khosrau was deposed, the great Persian poet and musician Barbat bewailed, "O great Khosrau, great in your majesty, in warlike pride and in magnanimity, where is that greatness now, your high renown, your glory and your throne and your royal crown?" Barbat then continued, "And as your seed degenerates this land, degenerates below an alien hand. It is the shepherd's fault when the wolves descend and ravage all the sheep he should defend." And the wolves were indeed circling, both on the northern steppes of Central Asia and in the southern deserts of Arabia. The defeat of the Persians and the deposition of Khosrau would mark the beginning of a period of political turmoil that would end only with the coming of the armies of Islam, when, in the words of the Shahnameh, the pulpit replaced the throne. But we'll get there soon enough. Heraclius, completely victorious, for a time, returned to Byzantium. By 629, the war was over. Both Byzantium and Iran were horribly weakened, one of them mortally. But the Turks, on the other hand, had actually seemed to come out of this quite well. Iran was in turmoil, unable to exert control over the Silk Road cities. Even the Sassanid dynasty itself was on the ropes, racked by internal revolt and chaos as the authority of the Shah collapsed. Tong Yabgu Khan had no intention of giving up the territory he had gained in the Caucasus. He now held the very keys to the settled world's gates. No one could stop a Turkish advance into Iran. But he didn't want to just raid and return to the steppes, you know, like had happened during the Second Gokturk and Persian War. He fully intended to incorporate Iran as conquered territory, a subject of the Western Khanate. At home, it would seem that he had solidified his rule. He was, of course, victorious in war, and the Turkish armies returned home laden with riches and plunder. Gifts and treasures came pouring into the Khanate from elsewhere as well. In 627, the newly established Tang dynasty in China sent an emissary to the court of Tong Yabgu Khan, carrying 10,000 robes with strings of gold and over 1,000 fine horses, as essentially a bribe to stop Tong Yabgu Khan from riding east and aiding his eastern cousins in their struggle with the Tang that we will discuss next episode. To the south, Tong Yabgu Khan had taken advantage of Sassanid weakness during the 600s to expand his power as far south as Kashmir, in the north of today's Pakistan and India. So following the defeat of the Persians by the Romans and the Turks, Tong Yabgu Khan made up his mind to fully conquer the Persian Empire. The Sassanids, broken by decades of war and riven by disease, famine, and internal struggles for succession, were tottering. In 629, Tong Yabgu Khan again dispatched Buri Shad with a huge army, this time composed of at least 30,000 men, south to Iran through the Caucasus. The Armenian sources say that the Turks spread terror and dread over the face of the earth. The famous Persian general Shahrbaraz led an army of 10,000 north to fight the Turks. His army actually included some Arab auxiliary forces, fleeing the rise of a certain little-known prophet who had recently established a base near the Arab town of Medina. The sources say that Shahrbaraz wanted to trample the Turks beneath the hooves and the chests of horses and scatter them like dust in the wind. But the Turks deployed the classic steppe tactic of the feigned retreat, drawing the Sassanid forces into a trap. When the Sassanids chased after the supposedly fleeing Turks, they galloped right into the trap, whereupon the Turks turned around, surrounded them, and crushed them. The entire Persian army was destroyed. Shahrbaraz barely escaped. He fled for his life, returning to the center of the empire to join the fight for the throne. The throne of a reeling and collapsing empire. So the road into Persia now seemed wide open to the Turks. The Sassanid Empire was in crisis, mortally wounded by the war with Heraclius and Tong Yabgu Khan. As one historian has said, the Turks now looked set to add Persia to their dazzling list of acquisitions. But events to the east would prove otherwise. Tong Yabgu Khan had been too focused on events in the west and had turned his eyes away from the east. He had been put in power by the Nushibi, the western wing of the Ten Arrows, and he had ignored the eastern wing for far too long. As Kaga Kanvatsi said, the cauldron of the north had turned his face against his own sons. His rivals in the Dolu faction had been given time and space to prepare and to strike, and in 630, just 1 year off his great victory, Tong Yabgu Khan faced a great revolt by the Dolu, this time aided by the Karluks, one of the subject peoples of the Khanate. And he lost. He was assassinated by his uncle Bahadur, who replaced him as Khan with the support of the Dolu tribes. Reportedly, the newly established Tang dynasty sent silk robes covered with gems as a funerary gift to the Turks, to be wrapped around the body of the great Khan. Tong Yabgu Khan was the last great Khan of the Western Khanate. More than being a great general, I think he was a great politician. He and his brother came to power not through force of arms, but through negotiation and diplomacy with the Sui and with the other Turkish nobles. They convinced their way onto the throne. They didn't fight their way onto it. And when he was Khan himself, Tong Yabgu Khan was very canny in balancing the internal politics of the Khanate. He recognized that maintaining the peace between the two wings of the Ten Arrows was the critical way to both remain in power and to keep the Khanate strong. His fall came not from without, but from within, when he finally slipped up and was unable to maintain this delicate balancing act. But for years, he had been greatly successful at this very difficult task, and his successors would not be able to pull off the trick at all. Just like the demise of Tardu, the demise of Tong Yabgu Khan would plunge the state into chaos. The opportunity to topple the tottering Sassanid Empire and become rulers of Iran slipped from the Turks and was lost. Instead, it was taken up by another of the peripheral peoples, the successors of that obscure prophet in the wilderness of Arabia. Ultimately, for the Turkish Khanate, the missed opportunity to conquer Iran was not the primary problem. the chaos resulting from the fall of Tong Yabgu Khan would not end with a renewed Turkish Khanate. It would end in its conquest and disintegration. Because far to the east, a new power was rising. And next time, we will discuss that power, which would come to overthrow the Eastern Khanate and restore, after a period of 300 years, a strong and united China. So join us next time as we discuss the rise of the Tang Dynasty and the beginning of the end of the Göktürk Khanate.